Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing our graduates to hit the ground running.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Woody Guthrie sang about the Ludlow Massacre. Mother Jones herself called on the miners to fight. Labor icon Joe Hill rose out of the great coal field wars. Colorado, a spring morning, 1914, was the heart of the battle over coal and pay and power. A new history tells the story from the coal beds up. This hour, On Point, guns, coal, miners, Rockefellers, and the deadliest labor conflict in U.S. history. Joining me now from Denver is Thomas Andrews, assistant professor of history at the University of Colorado. His terrific new book is Killing for Coal, America's Deadliest Labor War. Thomas Andrews, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
It's wonderful to have you, and I wish you'd take us back and just kind of set the table. We'll have many listeners who don't know a thing about this massacre or its context. You say that Killing for Coal is set in southern Colorado, coal fields, from the 1870s through the great coal field war of 1913-1914. Set the table for us. What was going on in Colorado in these coal fields in those decades?
Well, there was a tremendous growth of the mining industry, which brought tens of thousands of men, women, and children from around the world to fairly desolate foothills where the high plains kind of rise up into the Rocky Mountains, and so the coal fields were sort of fueling the whole sort of rise of the Rocky Mountain West, the whole industrial economy that was really sort of taking root in this region. And in the process, they were sort of, undergirding a lot of the social conflicts that erupted throughout this region during that time period.
Drawing in the labor, drawing out the coal, shaping, as you say, that energy source, shaping a whole industrial economy and rising urban economy around it in Colorado and beyond. I wish we could go right to April 20th, 1914. If you can just describe what happened on that day. We'll backfill. We'll go down in the mines. But but give us a picture of the sort of climax of all this. I'm looking at photographs from your book. They're just astounding. I mean, it looks like war. What happened on that day?
Well, there really are sort of two sets of stories about what happened on that day. But the things they agree on is that, first of all, just to kind of set the scene, Ludlow was a tent colony inhabited by about 1,200 strikers,
men, women, and children. Living in tents, okay.
Yeah, living in tents, and they were members of the United Mine Workers of America, which at the time was the largest union in the United States, and they were on strike against the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company and its competitors. And the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company had been owned by the Rockefeller family since about 1903. Mm-hmm. And so over the preceding months, this coalfield war had cost about 30 lives. It had already made headlines nationwide. A lot of the sort of best reporters, best journalists of the era had already been out to sort of report on what was going on in this area. On the morning of April 20th, my sense and the argument I make in the book is that really both sides expected the worst of each other.
The miners were fully armed up. So was the National Guard and militia that were there.
Yeah, there was actually a fairly small detachment of militia. The governor of Colorado, Elias Ammons, had withdrawn most of the militia. There had been several hundred militia in southern Colorado since about October. And a few weeks prior to Ludlow, he actually had withdrawn most of the militia. And so there was one company near Ludlow and a few dozen troops nearby. So it was a relatively small contingent of militia.
But the tensions had been very high. I don't say that this is history, but when Woody Guthrie finally sang about it from the miners' point of view, he sang, "I was worried bad about my children, soldiers guarding the railroad bridge. Every once in a while, a bullet would fly, kick up gravel under my feet. We were so afraid you would kill our children. We dug us a cave that was 7 foot deep, carried our young ones and pregnant women down inside the cave to sleep You snuck around our little tent town, soaked our tents with your kerosene. You struck a match, and in the blaze that started, you pulled the triggers of your Gatling guns. Fair or labor only?
Well, I think Woody Guthrie was a little bit, slanted the story a little bit. In particular, I haven't been able to find any solid evidence of intent by the militia to kill people by setting the tent colony on fire. This was definitely a battle. There was definitely intention by the militia to attack the colony and probably to wipe the colony out.
And there were caves that had been dug by miners under their tents as sort of safe retreats, but turned into death chambers for the families that went down when the fire enveloped the whole tent camp.
Yeah, they were essentially cellars, that were dug the previous fall. When the strikers realized that this fight was going to last, and from Ludlow's beginnings in September, from the moment the tent colony was created, it was really sort of the epicenter of fighting. And so several people had been killed in Ludlow by October of 1913. And, it simply wasn't a safe place. There were people getting killed on both sides. Gunfights were frequent. And so miners, dug these cellars to protect their families. And so when the fighting broke out, I should sort of step back and talk about how the fighting did break out on the morning of April 20th. Guthrie's accurate in sort of portraying the level of harassment that strikers had experienced by militiamen over the preceding days.
And they were striking for pay or for the way they were compensated specifically, or conditions, or both?
Well, the real sticking point in the strike, and the thing that made it such an epic struggle and such an important struggle nationally, was unionization was really far and away the most important issue. Mm-hmm. So the strikers were demanding that the operators recognize the United Mine Workers of America. They were also asking for better pay. They wanted the 8-hour law, which was state law. They wanted that enforced. They wanted a new mining law that the state of Colorado had drawn up in 1913, mm-hmm. which had all sorts of mandates for safety conditions and work rules. They wanted that to be respected. And they also had a series of grievances that are a little bit tougher to understand, but that basically involved getting compensated for more of the work they were doing. Basically, coal miners during this era only got paid for they got paid by the ton. Mm-hmm. So they only got paid for the coal they extracted. There was all sorts of other labor required to safeguard their lives.
No matter how much stone they had to get out of the way or how much wood they had to put up to make the tunnel safe on the way down. So we'll look at those issues. But then on that morning, how did it begin?
Well, it began with the militia came to the militia leader came to the tent of Louis Tikas, the leader of the Greek strikers, who was essentially sort of they called him the captain of the Ludlow colony. There's a whole sort of organization in place by which the union sort of administered the colony, and Louis Tikas was the head of the colony. Hamrock was the militiaman. The militia leader came to Tikas seeking, basically a woman had come to him with a story that her husband was being held against his will in the tent colony. Mm-hmm. And while Hamrock and Tikas were talking, a couple of, they're described as sort of, bombs, a couple of explosions went off. And at that point, it was pretty much go time. And it's really not clear who shot first. Both sides were ready to fight. Both sides expected that a fight would erupt at any moment. And so, I think it really was one of those situations where all it took was, all it took was one person to pull the trigger, and then the fighting was
all out wild gunfire, and ultimately the fire in the tent colony. When it was over, how many dead?
There were 20 dead total that day. There was one militiaman killed. There was one man who was basically a bystander, and then there were 18 strikers. And most of the strikers who were killed were women and children who were in one of those cellars dug beneath the tents. They were killed by, they're basically asphyxiated as the fire that was raging above their heads consumed all the oxygen.
And the total death toll for the Great Coalfield War, as you and others describe it?
It was at least 80, and it may have been as high as 100. especially during the fighting that erupted after Ludlow. You know, some folks may have been killed and sort of buried unsung and unrecorded.
We're going to follow the strands out of that day and that killing. They go in many directions, really interesting, to the mansions of the Rockefellers, to Denver and urban growth and the families using energy there, sort of blithely then as we do now, and also right into nature itself. You call this in no small part, Thomas Andrews, an environmental history.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. And, one of the things I'm really trying to do in the book is to show how nature mattered for working people, in very different ways than it mattered for people like the Rockefellers or for other mining barons during this era. But for working people, the sort of daily experience of contact with the nature of the coal mines was very pivotal in sort of shaping their sense of themselves and in shaping their politics and their sort of collective movements.
Thomas Andrews joins us from Denver, Colorado. He's author of the new book, Killing for Coal, America's Deadliest Labor War. We'll go out with Woody Guthrie and his Ludlow Massacre from the 1940s. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
That very night you soldiers waited till all us miners was asleep. You snuck around our little tent town, soaked our tents with your kerosene. You struck a match and the blaze it started. You pulled the triggers of your Gatling guns. I made a run for the children, but a firewall stopped me.
We're talking this hour about the deadliest labor conflict in U.S. history. In Colorado, the foothills, 1914, over coal. Thomas Andrews joins us from Denver, Colorado. And Professor Andrews, I wish you'd pull the curtain way back now. We've got just the slimmest sense of the action of that day, a strike underway, largely over unionization and issues around that. National Guard deployed, militiamen there, rifles among the striking miners, too. A real fight on that day, and it looks Wild West in the photographs that remained. Fire, gunfire, and a lot of dead at the end of that day. But you pull the curtains all the way back to a kind of 70 million year time frame and describe it as Caleb Crane reviewed your book in The New Yorker as much about geology as ideology. Give us that really big frame.
Well, I think the important thing to sort of grasp here is just how energy poor the Rocky Mountain West was in sort of frontier days in the Native American period. And this really is an energy poor landscape, a place of sort of low biological productivity, as indicated by the sort of lack of trees and
not a lot of firewood
in most of Colorado. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not a lot of firewood. And then meanwhile, it's an arid landscape, and so there's not a lot of water power that's very useful. But what the region did have, which had become tremendously significant, is it had very, very extensive deposits of coal. So back during the Cretaceous period, when the Rocky Mountains first started pushing up, most of what's now Colorado was underneath it was basically sort of a shallow, warm ocean. Geologists call it various things, but usually something like the Late Cretaceous Seaway. And as the Rockies started pushing up, conditions changed. You know, the land started rising out of the ocean and essentially became sort of an environment not unlike the Everglades or like Borneo. Those are sort of two good modern day analogs for what it was like in Colorado about 70 million years ago.
And so it's hard to picture there in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, but nevertheless, that's the fact.
Yeah. So miners were living in these scrub landscapes with pinyon pine and juniper, but when they went down into the mines, they could actually see impressions of breadfruit trees and fig trees and redwoods. And, they could actually sort of tell what the vegetation had once been like in the area, how incredibly lush it was. And so over millions of years...
Just pause there, I was fascinated by your description of how the miner's own sense of the world of possibility was in a way shaped by what they saw deep down in those tunnels in their individual rooms where they were at it by breadfruit fossils in the stone.
Yeah, and I think you know, a lot of the miners, especially the British American ones, who tended to be the ones who'd sort of grown up in coal mining, a lot of them were actually quite widely read and kept up on the latest sort of scientific literature. And so they were fairly up to date in terms of scientific understandings of where coal had come from. And, they really sort of matched what they saw underground with what they learned by reading various, journals and books and that sort of thing.
How did what they saw and experienced down in the mines shape their willingness above the mines to become so militant? How did it factor in?
Well, I think in all sorts of ways, it takes a little, it takes a little while to sort of unravel all of those connections. But a couple of the most significant ones, one is that their work was actually very independent. They had a great deal of autonomy underground. So coal miners mostly, throughout this period, the coal mines were unmechanized for the most part. And so this was traditional pick mining. Most miners worked in a room alone with one other partner.
You call it a room as they did, but it's really it's the space that each of them would be given to go at, to pull their coal out of. That was their room.
Yeah, you can sort of imagine it like a, it was a little bit more messy, but the basic shape of a coal mine was usually like a city. So it was a gridded sort of, it was a gridded space. And so the blocks of a city kind of corresponded to the rooms of a mine.
How far underground in this area generally?
Well, they were, most of these, there were three mining counties in southern Colorado, and in two of the counties, these were mostly drift mines, which meant that the mine just kind of went into the hillside.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a shaft. In the other county, up toward Canyon City, there were shafts. The mines by the 1890s, some of them went as far in as 5 miles. So they weren't 5 miles underground, but they were 5 miles into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And so they could get quite large. Might be as many as 400 men working at one time underground. Most of the mines would be more like 100, 150 men.
And it was dangerous geology in Colorado because of the structure there. This wasn't settled. It could move.
Yeah, I mean, the basic problem with coal mining, the reason why it's always been so dangerous is what coal miners are attempting to do is to systematically remove an entire strata of the earth. And so one consequence of that is, of course, the earth wants to push down constantly. Another problem is that the whole reason that miners wanted coal and the whole reason that that consumers wanted coal is that the stuff burned. So it's this highly flammable material. In Colorado, especially in southern and western Colorado, the coal seams were suffused or they were permeated with methane, and which is highly explosive. Mm-hmm. And then a further problem that made the Colorado coal mines the most dangerous in the United States during this time period is that in extreme southern Colorado, in particular, the climate's extremely dry, and so coal dust would be in the atmosphere underground, and there's really no moisture to sort of knock it down. There was no moisture to sort of guard against explosions. And so large mine disasters were all too common. The first big one was in 1884 in Crested Butte, which most of us now think of as this sort of idyllic ski town, but Crested Butte is actually a coal mining town. And so the Jokerville mine exploded there in 1884 and killed 59 men and boys.
The miners in these big, brutal, in many ways, mines would make pets of mice, you write, because the mice would be super sensitive to changes in the atmosphere and sometimes could alert them to the impending crisis.
Yeah, that was one of my sort of favorite discoveries in researching and writing the book was the sort of relationship between miners and animals underground. Because the sort of, if you sort of boil it down, the two most important skills of a coal miner, one was knowing how to take out as much coal as possible since they were paid by the ton. But a lot of the skill simply involved, it wasn't simple, but it involved trying to stay alive underground. And miners used sort of every tool, every technique they could figure out that would sort of help them in that. And one of the things they did is they sort of befriended or made pets of the mice that lived in their rooms. So mine mice came underground in bales of hay that were fed to the mules, which were the other major sort of species underground. And coal miners befriended mice because they realized that mice were both very sensitive to carbon monoxide, and also mice had a real knack for sort of predicting when the roof was going to fall or when the coal face was going to fall, because they could usually hear or feel when micro cracks developed that sort of preceded a larger fall.
When the mice in the mine were nervous, you should be wary too.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what miners said in some oral histories was, you know, if the mice get out of the mine, or if the mice start getting out of your room, you better get out too, because something's going to go wrong.
A history less moral and more mineral, it's been said of Thomas Andrews' book, Killing for Coal. You've got listeners who want to join the conversation. Dave in Northampton, Massachusetts. Dave, you're on the air.
Oh, hello. I was just saying to the person there in your newsroom that in 1980, I was driving from Denver down to Mexico, and I'm a union truck driver and have been for many years, so labor history is very important to me. Mm-hmm. And I stopped and visited Ludlow. There's a monument there. At least there was back then. I don't know who erected the monument, but it's right off the U.S. highway that passes through that town. And, you know, certainly it was a very moving experience just to witness that, you know, that place.
And what did it say to you, Dave? Dave, as a union truck driver, what did that monument say to you, that incident say to you?
Well, it says, you know, how all the blood, you know, that was spilled to get where we are today. And, you know, those people sacrificed, you know, so much to lay the foundations of the U.S. labor movement. That's what it said to me. But I was also, you know, there was a convenience store in the town of Ludlow back then that was giving away a pamphlet on the massacre, and I think it was a thesis that was written. You have to excuse me, I'm trying to back into a loading dock right now as I was thinking, but okay. It was a thesis written by a guy, and my memory in reading about it was that the evidence that he had found was that it was very deliberate and premeditated, you know, the burning of the camps. And, you know, that's not what I was hearing from your guests, so, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of conflicting evidence, but that, you know, that was my memory of the history that was, you know, described, you know, with that event.
Dave, we'll pick it up. Keep an eye on your mirror there. Drive safe. Thomas Andrews, what about it? How is the massacre remembered today? And is there still a battle over the memory and who did what when?
Well, the whole story of how the massacre's been remembered is actually a really fascinating one. So it was, I mean, even as the fighting was going on, the two major sides were already sort of spinning events in their own way. And so, you know, and very famously after the massacre, Rockefeller hired Ivy Lee, who many folks consider sort of the father of modern public relations, to give sort of the company spin or the state of Colorado spin on these events. And so from the very beginning, you know, two really different stories emerge, and both sides were very conscious of sort of the public spotlight. And so I think one of the problems is that, you know, all sorts of records were clearly sanitized or simply weren't, you know, things simply weren't kept if they were too incriminating. And so there's sort of a, you know, I mean, I think it's entirely possible that this was premeditated. That's plausible. But there's no sort of smoking gun.
Premeditated on the part of the mine owners and the government officials who were lined up with them.
Yeah. I mean, they definitely for a long time, you know, I mean, back in October, John Osgood, who had been sort of the major figure in Colorado Fuel and Iron and was now head of the second largest company in the area, Victor American. John C. Osgood from the very beginning called Ludlow the center of devilment. And, you know, it was no secret that mine owners and militia leaders, you know, would have been happy to see Ludlow disappear.
And you know, looking at the photographs in your book, it essentially did. I mean, it was just burnt to a horrible crisp here.
Yeah, which left 1,200 people homeless, and so the union had to sort of scramble and, you know, create refugee camps and all of that. Meanwhile, hundreds of the men and boys from Ludlow basically sort of took to the hills and started fighting a guerrilla war. You know, and so what's interesting too is that Ludlow itself has been sort of memorialized. The union, the United Mine Workers of America, erected a very moving monument on the site of the right next to the cellar where the women and children died.
Mm-hmm.
And they erected that in 1918, actually right as John D. Rockefeller Jr. happened to be touring the Southern Colorado coalfields. And so Rockefeller was present when that monument was unveiled.
Take a look at this, John D. Let me get one more caller before the break on this point, if I may, from Quincy, Massachusetts. Satiti is on the air. Satiti, hi.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know?
Well, what I know is I teach communications. I'm a professor of communications at Eastern Nazarene College in Quincy.
Mm-hmm.
And I teach this the Ludlow Massacre from the point of view of public relations, and that Ivy, as was mentioned by your guest, Ivy Ledbetter Lee, was really one of the founders of public relations. And this event had implications far beyond the immediate massacre.
The whole country was paying attention.
That's right. And public relations came of age in part from this. It was Lee who resurrected the image of the Rockefellers, and it's the sort of benign image we have today that came as an aftermath of this this crisis. The Rockefellers hired him, and there's a very famous event where John Rockefeller Jr. went to Ludlow and danced with the miner's wife, the wives of the miners, trying kind of like a political campaign to resurrect their image.
Yes, Thomas Andrews, you write about how Rockefeller was out in the rest of the world trying to describe himself as being on the side of angels in Ludlow.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, there's this huge contradiction in Rockefeller, in what the Rockefellers have been doing for some time that Ludlow really exposed, which by this point, the Rockefellers were quite well known and quite widely known for their philanthropy. And yet, on the other hand, they were also widely disparaged for the activities of Standard Oil, as well as for what Colorado Fuel and Iron was doing, as well as for what several of their other operations were doing.
And being prepared to brutally oppose unionization when the reports came in of trouble there. You report Rockefeller saying, what about the coal? How much coal are you producing? Never mind all that.
Yeah, and actually, the sort of first correspondence that Rockefeller received that mentioned the strike in the copy of that letter in the Rockefeller archives in Pocantico Hills, New York, it's actually scribbled on there in pencil, irrelevant. And so for several weeks, Rockefeller simply ignored that this strike was happening. But as your caller pointed out, Ludlow did become very, very critical in the Rockefeller family's, largely successful attempt to sort of remake their public image. And so Rockefeller, with Lee's help, and also with the help of William Lyon Mackenzie King, who would go on to be Canadian Prime Minister and had previously been the Labor Minister in Canada, basically sort of created a new memory of Ludlow, in which this was the event that sort of finally made it clear to the Rockefellers that they needed to sort of take the welfare of their workers more seriously. So this led to what was called the Rockefeller Plan, which was essentially a company union.
We've got to go up for a short break here. A journalist out of Denver at the time, Don McGregor, wrote in the September before he saw the outward sign of civil war, red and bloody, with its hates and its assassinations, its woes and its suffering. Joe Hill, a famous figure from famous folk song, out of this same turf, died in 1915 in the coal fields. Here's a version of that famous song sung by Earl Robinson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
At their side, Joe Hill is at their side. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, says he, you'll find Joe Hill. Says he.
The shooting started April 20, 1914, about 9 o'clock on a bright, breezy morning. Thomas Andrews tells us Colorado National Guard was there. There'd been 7 months of shootouts and assassinations and executions and ambushes. When the firing started, guardsmen's fire was returned by hundreds of striking coal miners, a dozen nationalities. Before it was over, canvas dwellings, big town of tents, all ablaze. In one cellar hideout, 2 women and 11 children killed, asphyxiated when the flames devoured the tents over their heads. The leader of the Greek strikers, at least, Louis Tikas, died, multiple gunshot wounds in the back, and the family names of 18 strikers killed showed the kind of ethnic diversity there. Snyder and Tikas, Costa and Valdez and Pedregon. A big history And Thomas Andrews tells it as environmental history from the ancient making of the coal right forward. You can join us at 1-800-423-TALK. Let's get a call from Naples, Florida. And Nick. Nick, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm on the air. My father was an immigrant coal miner who immigrated from Bulgaria, and he worked in two coal mines, Berwyn and Tabasco, which were near Ludlow.
Yes.
And I was born in Tabasco in December of 1924.
This is just up the pike from Ludlow. This is right in the neighborhood, Nick. You were right there.
Right in the neighborhood, yes.
1924. Wow.
And growing up, I remember on a number of occasions visiting the Ludlow Monument, and of course, after I grew up, I've taken my wife back there and friends to view the Ludlow Monument.
Mm-hmm.
My recollections following the strike, the Rockefeller families, the Rockefeller owners did make some improvements for coal mines, doing some things such as improving the schools and so on. But still, for years after the strike, the coal miners held a deep resentment against the coal mine owners because of their feelings toward that. And Tom Andrews mentioned that that refugee camps were built after the firing or the fires that started in the tent villages.
Yes.
But my understanding was that the tent villages themselves were built almost as refugee camps because the coal miners were forced out of their company-owned homes and had no other places to live, so they erected these tent villages in which to live.
They called it the White City in a kind of mocking reference to the glorious white buildings at the Chicago World's Fair. This was not glorious, you're reminding us, Nick.
I'm sorry, I missed that part.
These were tough circumstances. They were in these tents. Was your father there in 1914 when the massacre took place? Was he in Tabasco up the road or not?
Yes, I'm not sure exactly where he was during the strike itself. Although he had immigrated to the United States in 1911,
mm-hmm.
But for some reason we never did discuss exactly where he was during that. There's some construction going on in my area, so that's why you hear some pounding every now and then.
You're not down in the mines. Let us take your basic question to Tom Andrews, and stick with us, Nick. Tom, you hear the question about the tent camp itself and why the miners were in this, what was called the biggest tent camp in American history there.
Yeah, your call, that was just a wonderful call for me to hear, so I really appreciate it. Points out, the tent colonies were really created because once miners went on strike, there were clauses in their leases. You know, the majority of them did live in company housing, and so when they went on strike, their leases were revoked, and they were kicked out of their homes, usually within 2 or 3 days. And so actually Don McGregor, the journalist you quoted a few mm-hmm. minutes ago, has just some absolutely heartbreaking coverage of what he called the exodus down from the coal camps. And so there's, you know, just incredible displacement marked this strike. Several thousand miners left the coal fields in advance of the strike because they didn't want to fight this battle, or they didn't feel like they could. You know, they had children to support.
They could see it coming, though.
They could see it coming. Oh, yeah, everybody could see it coming. Mm-hmm. It was very clear for many months before the strike was actually called, that this was in the works.
Nick, in Naples, Florida, if I may ask you, you know, you were born just around the corner, 1924. You heard about it growing up. When you look back on it now, and you look at energy and labor and the world today, what do you take away from it? How does it inform the way you look at the world, Nick?
Well, of course, I was profoundly affected by it in several ways. First of all, because my father, who worked in those coal mines, was when those coal mines closed near the Trinidad or near Ludlow.
Yes,
he was transferred or had an opportunity to move to a coal mining camp outside of another town called Walsenburg.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up there, went through school, and so on. But shortly after he went there, my father was crippled in a coal mining accident and was never worked again.
Wow.
And, of course, during that period of time, the coal miners other than having hospitalization, which they received at the company-owned hospital in Pueblo, Colorado, Corwin Hospital. Other than that, the only compensation my mother got was that we were allowed to live in the company-owned house until my father was released from the hospital, and then we had to leave there. And as I recall, he got all of $1,000 compensation paid, being crippled for life after that.
Wow.
And so I take away from that the fight or the conflict between the mine owners and the miners themselves, which was aggravated to a certain extent because the coal mines in South Central Colorado at that time were being depleted of the easily mined coal. Gradually, all of those coal mines died. The coal mining house where I was born is no longer there. It's just the foundations. And the coal mining house where I lived when I went to grade school is no longer there. It's just a foundation there. I go back there and have a reunion with my high school graduates, and we reminisce about the tough times that we grew up in there.
Nick, you remind us of those times. You remind us of them vividly and how real this history is, what it means to individual families. Your own father crippled and off with $1,000. I'm very grateful for your call. And Tom Andrews, I wonder how you look at this question. You remind us that Woody Guthrie, we heard, Howard Zinn, historian, others, look at the Great Coalfield War, Ludlow, and say, well, here's why we needed a New Deal. You also remind us that in Colorado, this just blew society up in a way. And the feelings are very mixed when people looked back on Ludlow.
Yeah, very much so. And I think in the coal fields themselves, it took people several years to sort of put the pieces back together again. And you know, in a lot of cases, they never really could put them back together again because they'd lost family members or, there's some very touching oral histories in which miners who had committed violence during the strike, broke down when they were talking to interviewers because they could finally sort of talk about somebody that they'd killed 70 years before, and they could finally sort of get a bit of, they could finally let it out. And so the pain, just immense pain and suffering in this region. And so I think that one of the things that I really try to do in the book then is folks like Zinn and George McGovern and Woody Guthrie and so forth. I think they remind
George
us
McGovern,
of
the presidential candidate and senator who wrote about this.
Yeah, he did. He George McGovern actually had a PhD in history from Northwestern, and his dissertation was on Ludlow, and then it was sort of ghost written as a book in 1972 with a man named Leonard Guttridge. Very fine book, really sort of still the standard work on the subject. But I think one of the things that I really try to do in my book is to really sort of bring out the extent to which these struggles really were about regular people. That really were coming out of the mines, coming out of this day-to-day suffering of, fathers getting crippled and that sort of thing. And, because there's a whole other part of the story that sort of involves union geopolitics and industrial geopolitics and the sort of, jockeying for position between the Rockefellers and the United Mine Workers, which was the largest union in the country. Mm-hmm. But sometimes that part of the story can kind of obscure what was happening on the ground in Southern Colorado. So I really appreciate how your caller kind of brings us back to, Berwind and Hastings and Tabasco, the camps he mentions. These are the places where the folks in Ludlow came from. Those are the towns that they got kicked out of. This is why they had to go live in Ludlow.
And the places that Nick himself came out of in Naples, Florida. Let me get another here from Bloomingdale, New York, and Dave. Dave, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks.
Thank you.
My grandfather worked in the coal mines in England.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up dying of black lung disease at the age of 60. And my father is still alive. He's 83. But my grandfather told us stories back, when I was a little kid about, to scare us not to go into the coal mining business, so to speak.
Because it's rough down there in the mine.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he described it. Yeah, it was... But anyway, he said that he saw interesting fossils that were destroyed, and they would just drill through and blast through.
Sure.
And, you know, he always thought it was like a prehistoric fossil or something like that. I guess nowadays you'd have the archaeologists come in and excavate if something like that happened. But, you know, my question is this coal, you know, the whole deal with coal, was that sparked by those that depended on coal like we do for oil today, going over to Iraq and going to war and everything and killing women and children like they did at that tent city? That sounds terrible. So,
Dave, let us pick it up. Tom Andrews, you've got the photographs in your book of the sort of happy little families in Denver in homes heated by that coal. And it's all sort of, you know, comfy and the carpet's on the floor. But your book really does, as Dave points out, make clear the kind of violence at the other end, the producing end of that chain. What about Dave's question? And that same chain today we hear out of, you know, sort of the coal-fired zones off the coast of Africa, Nigeria, and other places where it's still rough where the energy originates.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm really interested in trying to sort of bring out in the book is this connection between the rise of fossil fuel dependency, sort of increasing social inequality and violence. You know, and so I think that in 1913, 1914, you know, that violence was to some extent fueled or at least facilitated by the consumption, by the sort of energy hunger of consumers in places like Denver. And I think today, you know, violence is still, you know, and actually much more violence probably is breaking out around the world because of our ongoing addiction to fossil fuels.
Dave looks at Iraq and the death toll there, civilian toll, makes Ludlow look puny, bad as it was.
Exactly. And we can look to China as well, which is undergoing its own coal-fired transformation right now. And, you know, upwards of, I guess the best estimates I've seen is that something like 6,000 miners lose their lives every year in China right now.
I want to get one more call, if I may. Our time dwindles. Anne is in Easton, Massachusetts. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think, Anne?
Great conversation. I just wanted to compliment the author for bringing this really important chapter of history forward for us to talk about now. I think it's really important. I think it's a history we've lost. Thanks very much.
Well,
you're welcome.
A simple thanks. I've got to ask you about the labor implications themselves. I mean, from what you saw, this is a complex picture. But it was essentially miners standing up ultimately with guns and fighting with owners over the conditions of their labor and that energy they were pulling out of the ground. How does it leave you looking at labor issues then and now, Tom?
Well, that's a big question.
Yes.
I think it, you know, I mean, it reinforces several things, or it really sort of highlights several things for me. One is just the centrality of working people to our economy, and yet how often the sort of the, you know, suffering of workers can go ignored. You know, and I think that's sort of an enduring theme that we still need to pay attention to. I think, there's a lot of sort of resonance in the story of Ludlow that sort of impacts on present day events. For instance, the importance of sort of nonviolent strategies through which workers, through which working people can sort of achieve their aims. Ludlow, the violence at Ludlow and the violence that followed Ludlow really happened because no other mechanism was working. You know, I mean, Colorado workers had tried to use the ballot. They'd tried to use the courts. They'd tried virtually every mechanism they could. And I think that in the present day, you know, I think in the last several years, a lot of the sort of peaceful avenues for workers to seek redress have been sort of closed off, and I think that's a dangerous situation.
Are you concerned that our contemporary energy appetites may roll over Colorado again? I mean, there's talk about, you know, all kinds of measures that may need to be taken if oil is dwindling. Is this a finished story in Colorado?
No, it isn't. Colorado mines more coal now than it ever did during this period. The mines are quite different, and they tend to be located further north and west, and they're, you know, highly mechanized. They're mostly underground, not like the big strip mines in Wyoming. But, you know, when we talk about energy security, I think we do need to really have honest conversations about what this is going to mean for both for the environment and for American workers. And currently in Colorado, there is really sort of a wave of energy development, particularly on the western slope. But also, a lot of energy companies are turning back toward these old coal mining regions in southern Colorado, especially to get at that coal bed methane.
Mm. Thomas G. Andrews is author of the new book, and a great new book, Killing for Coal, America's Deadliest Labor War. Tom Andrews, thanks so much for taking us back to this important history today. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, and thank you to your callers, too.
We'll go out with Merle Travis singing 16 Tons. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
A lot of men didn't, and a lot of men died. I got a fist of iron and a fist of steel. If the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16 tons, and what do you get? You get another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.